Politicians struggle to enact the things they run on, that regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers find they cannot pass whatever legislation they like. They find themselves bound by what is popular, or at least their sense of it. They can only enact laws within a narrow set of ideas, and that range is called the Overton Window. And on the Overton Window podcast, we look at issues around the country and talk to the people who change what is politically possible. Now, the political discussion focuses too much on big states. It's California and New York versus Texas and Florida, and the rest of the country just doesn't seem to matter that much. But there are states that have made major changes over the past few years. Montana is letting more people work without state approval, it's loosened rules in the medical field, and changed the rules to allow more housing to be built, and it's lowered taxes. And I'm talking with Kendall Cotton, the president and the CEO of the Frontier Institute, about it. Kendall, welcome.
Hey there, James. Good to be here.
What's going on in Montana?
Well, we've been busy here. We highlighted just a few weeks ago a big milestone that we've hit in the state. When the governor, Governor Gianforte, assumed office just about 3 years ago at this point, in 2021, he launched the Red Tape Relief Initiative. And he initiated a top-to-bottom review of all the regulations on the books. And looking back, it has really spurred a massive change in Montana in the regulatory landscape. In a lot of ways, Montanans are way more free than they were in 2021 today. So we really have a lot of wins to celebrate here in Montana. And it, you know, really is standing in stark contrast to what you see in Washington, D.C., where there's, you know, partisan gridlock and no one can agree on anything. And, you know, it's always talking about how can we spend more taxpayer money. In Montana, we've done almost the exact opposite. And we've said, instead of spending money, why don't we try getting our own house in order first, and address the barriers that are standing in the way of people getting to work, creating a business, building a home, you name it.
So I think a lot of governors kind of pursue this path of saying, look, let's do something about regulation, set up a committee to try and figure out what to do. And sometimes they lead to important reforms. Often they get rid of things that weren't even being enacted anyway, or weren't being administered anyway. But it seems that what's been going on in Montana is different. Why is that?
Well, I think that we are at a crisis point in Montana. You know, we're one of the fastest growing states in the nation, especially, you know, since the pandemic. A lot of people who were in states like California or on the coasts decided, why am I living in the city? Why am I not living in beautiful, you know, Bozeman, Montana, for instance? I think, you know, with remote work, that made it possible to... Exactly. You know, we really have something special here in Montana where, you know, you can be working at your office job and get off of work at 5 and then 20 minutes later be on the mountain bike path or be fishing a blue ribbon trout stream. So, you know, that's something that is extremely attractive to people in this age of remote work. And it's led to a lot of people seeking to live here. But what that's done is it's put a lot of pressure on Montana's market, and not just housing. I like to say that, you know, essentially, if you look at any issue that the biggest issues that Montana is dealing with, they all can be traced back to a supply problem. There's not enough homes. There's not enough education. There's not enough health care. You name it, we don't have enough. And so what that leads to is really a good opportunity to focus on reducing the barriers to creating more of whatever it is. And so I think that that's led, it's created an environment where, you know, the governor's focus on red tape relief and the legislature's willingness to address problems from a supply side, from a regulatory side, it's allowed them to really have some good pieces of legislation that are moving barriers to a lot of different areas of Montana's lives.
Well, let's get down to brass tacks. What changed? Or what are some examples of some things that have changed?
Yeah, you know, I wrote an op-ed about 3 weeks ago, just kind of highlighting a running list of all the things. And it's quite remarkable if you look back on it. And let's just kind of talk about the healthcare space in particular, because If you tally up all the regulatory reforms in the healthcare space that Montana has been able to pass in the last 3 years, it represents basically an entire transformation of the industry. We have authorized direct primary care providers in Montana. If folks aren't familiar with direct primary care, it's really the best representation of free market healthcare that we have. It's allowing doctors to set up like a Netflix subscription for their services, and people can pay $70 a month and get unlimited access to the doctor. They do house calls like the doctors of old. And that's something that we essentially legalized here in Montana. And it led to the creation of literally nearing 20 new businesses in the state that are providing patients with affordable quality healthcare. On top of that, we have passed several pieces of legislation that have expanded the scope of practice of healthcare providers that are here to do more to help patients. So for instance, this last year in 2023, we expanded the ability of pharmacists to, within their training, to actually prescribe, you know, minor medications. And that's really important for a rural state like Montana, because we don't have all the doctors that we need. We have something like 12 counties that don't even have a local primary care doctor. And so when people need a prescription, they got to drive an hour into town or more. And that really can be concerning, especially when you're dealing with something serious or something emerging that if it's not addressed in a timely fashion can lead to an ER visit. And that just drives up the cost of our healthcare system. So what we did is we said, hey, pharmacists, within their training, they're obviously experts in prescriptions. Anything that can be done with just a standard test that doesn't require a medical degree to administer, you know, we're talking like strep throats or a test for, you know, looking at UTIs and things like that. Really routine things that people go to the doctor's office for and then end up having to do another visit to the pharmacist to pick up their prescription. We allow that to happen all at the local drugstore now. And so that's really increasing access in these rural communities in Montana. One of the other things I'll mention lastly in the healthcare space is in 2021, we essentially repealed all but one of our certificate of need laws, completely repealing basically the requirement that a new healthcare business get permission from the government to start operating. And then even worse than that, you have to go around and survey your would-be competitors and ask them if your business competing with them is a good idea. So that is a really big deal. I know a lot of other states are dealing with certificate of need laws, and Montana was able to come together and eliminate just about.
So I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the certificate of need law process. As you said, like a lot of states have been interested in changing those rules to allow medical provisioners to open up without having to ask their competitors for permission, essentially. And they find that it's a really a hard battle because those incumbent providers are politically powerful. They're major employers in every legislative district. And they would prefer to have this control upon new entrants. So how did you get across that resistance in Montana?
You know, I think we had the benefit of a lot of momentum. So repealing certificate of need laws in Montana was something that had been tried before. Mm-hmm. I think there was a bill in 2019 in that legislative session to do this. And when our new governor came into power, that was the first time in literally 20 years that Republicans had a unified government in Montana. And so the big question was, well, what is a supermajority going to do now? And basically, a lot of legislators said, we need to pass the things that were vetoed by the Democratic governor before. And one of those things was certificate of need law. So there was a lot of motivation to finally get this across the finish line with a new unified Republican government. And so that played into it a little bit. But on the policy side, I think what happened is we were facing just such a dire healthcare shortage that legislators were looking for any ideas they could get to that would help expand the amount of healthcare businesses that are working in the state and increase access for patients. The interesting thing is I know a lot of states who have dealt with certificate of need laws face stiff opposition from, you know, particularly the nursing home groups and the long-term care groups. We actually had a nursing home work with us who wanted to, during the pandemic, wanted to you know, remodel their facility and accommodate, you know, kind of a social distance and put their patients in separate rooms. And they had to go get a certificate of need for that. And it would have ran them through so much red tape and cost them a lot of money. And so they stepped up and said, you know what, we've kind of changed this. And that played a big role in things too.
Okay, that's interesting. I guess that's a thing that does matter to something's political feasibility. If in a normal situation, yes, the incumbent providers have a lot of say, but if lawmakers think that it is popular to do something about or to expand access to healthcare, they look around for ideas that are out there, and that can sway the political feasibility of an issue. But I also think that a lot of these things do come down to personalities, which is, what is the governor interested in? And your governor seems to have been interested in a lot of good policies. So how much is personality driving the changes going on in Montana?
That's a great point. Our governor is very reform-minded, and he talks often about making five-yard plays. We don't need to try for a Hail Mary every single time. Let's just focus on the five-yard wins, and incrementally over time, we're going to completely transform the state into a much better place to live. So that really lends its hand in terms of a governing style to regulatory reforms, because at the end of the day, regulatory reforms, removing some of the regulatory barriers, letting people do more work or get a job easier, it's not a panacea. It's not something that's going to solve every issue. But over time, if you add up regulatory reforms, over time, that completely changes how the market works in the state, and it really will lead to a better outcome. So that's something our governor is committed to. And then, with that focus going into office, he's able to turn to partners like Frontier Institute in the state, think tanks whose job it is to basically have a running list of all the good ideas. And that's what we were able to do when legislators and the governor said, hey, we want to reduce red tape, make it easier to do business here, and that's going to be our focus. We said, great. We can do a lot of work in the healthcare space because there's a lot of red tape in there. We can work on housing together. We can look at many, many different areas. And so there's been a lot of work to get done.
So can you tell me a little bit more about the changes in housing policy that have been going on in Montana?
Sure. We had a really big win last year in 2023. We actually were able to put a bipartisan coalition together, folks on the left and the right, frankly, groups that we had never really even worked together with before, like renters advocacy groups and, groups that were advocating for the homeless and for social justice and things like that. We worked together with them, and we were able to a sweeping slate of pro-housing reforms. I mean, basically, it was a free market wish list that freed up property owners to build the homes that we need to build to keep up with all the demand and all the people moving here in Montana. And these were reforms that other states have tried and often failed to pass at the state level. And national media has kind of taken a note of what we've done in Montana, and they've dubbed it the Montana Housing Miracle. So we got the housing miracle done in Montana. And essentially what we've done is broadly expanded the freedom of property owners statewide to build affordable types of starter homes like duplexes and accessory dwelling units on their property in addition to a single family home if they choose. We also have completely, essentially repealed and replaced our entire land use planning statute to streamline the permit process and make it easier to build all types of homes so that we can drive down costs for everybody. Montana was dealing with a severe housing crisis, and we addressed it directly with free market reforms.
So can you tell me a little about your role in this in these reforms? You'd mentioned having some good ideas available when they were trying to look around at different policy areas. What exactly are you doing to help foster good changes in Montana?
Yeah, well, I mean, you talked a little bit about the Overton window, and that's the theme of this podcast, right? And that's exactly what we set out to do, especially in the housing space. You know, really what led to our success was we were able to start with a sound base of research. So we were looking around in 2021 and early 2022, and we noticed that, you know, housing was the biggest issue facing the state. If you asked anybody on the sidewalk, they would say the cost of housing is the biggest issue. And we looked around at what the local governments were proposing to do about it. And the only solutions that were coming up were saying, let's spend more taxpayer money, let's get the government involved with building homes. And that seemed interesting to us because, you know, from the research, from economics, we know that regulations play a huge role in the end cost of housing. So we set out essentially to provide local lawmakers and state lawmakers with some sound data to, you know, represent how regulations were actually playing a role in our housing crisis. That led us to create the Montana Zoning Atlas, which basically put on an interactive map that was really easy to use, where you can build things like duplexes and where you can't based on the zoning in a local city. And that really crystallized the issue. And it kickstarted a conversation across the state. When we published the report, we actually ended up having, you know, newspaper editorial boards responding and writing an editorial saying our local leaders need to do something about this. We had mayors and city council people reaching out to us saying, wow, I've been looking for a map like this. I've been curious about it for so long, and somebody finally did it. And eventually that research sparked enough of a conversation that it led the governor to call a housing task force together in the summer of 2022. And that task force, I was actually appointed as a member of that task force because of our work on the issue. And our research was able to essentially be used as justification for a lot of these solutions that were eventually recommended by that task force for the legislature to implement. From there, that task force really kickstarted that bipartisan coalition. From there, we were able to work with groups of all sorts to actually get these policy recommendations across the finish line. So like I said, you know, I think that we had the good fortune of being able to start from a position of sound data that made it crystal clear what the problem was and eventually made the solutions inevitable.
Okay, so I want to talk a little bit more about that atlas, because I think it helped answer a question that no one else had answered, provided some important information, which is you have restrictive zoning in Montana in all the major in all the major cities, and that restrictive zoning has said that we have a plan for every single lot of land within the city limits, and it probably said that you can only build single family homes in most places. And what you did was saying that, well, you know, there are other types of housing available, and if we want to do something about housing costs, we need to be open to other types of housing other than expensive single-family homes. And this kind of demonstrated to people, even skeptics, even people who might not even have been paying attention to this, that, oh, there are some things that we can do to improve our policies. You help change some minds. You help draw some attention to a particular set of ideas that did get some attention. And when lawmakers were interested in doing something about this, but not knowing what they were doing, they looked around and said, all right, we're going to get a task force. We might as well put you on that, which is where you go from working outside of the system to try and raise awareness to a problem to working within the system, trying to find compromises among the different players. And those are two very different skills, by the way, of being able to draw attention to an issue and then being able to negotiate through the political players that are part of the system. So can you tell me about both of those roles?
I guess, you know, one of the things that really was interesting is that our research was able to kind of go beyond economics and, you know, kind of the boring stuff that us folks in the policy world really get excited about, but regular people don't. You know, when we were able to pull maps out of our zoning atlas and, you know, create profiles for a city like Missoula, Montana, which is near where I grew up, we showed, you know, what it looks like, where you can build more affordable starter homes, like duplexes, and where you can't in the city, ended up being like 75% of the city was walled off to that sort of development, completely prohibited it. And then we were able to compare that, put it next to a zoning map of cities like Los Angeles, and they looked identical. And that's the biggest fear of anybody in Montana, is they don't want our state to become like California. And so, you know, that's how we were able to transcend a lot of the political divides here, is we were able to speak to something that all Montanans care about. They don't want to see our state, as we grow, become a state like California that just doesn't feel as special as what we have here. We lose the rural character of our communities, the access to the outdoors. That's not something that any Montanan wants. And that really drove this issue in the legislature in particular, and brought together, you know, frankly, even environmental groups got on board with that idea. And they said, you know, if we can free our cities to grow up, to grow a little denser, to build some more homes there to accommodate all the folks who are moving here from the city, maybe we can actually save some of the open land surrounding our cities, and that's good for the environment. So we were able to hone in on a message, because we have the data and the research, on a message that reached every Montana from every walk of life.
Now, Montana is still a small state. I think when I looked at the numbers, there's 1.1 million people living there. And it's been growing. It's been growing fast. And growth really matters. What are your prospects for the state's future?
Well, I think that Montana is really poised to be a leader in the economy of the future. I think it's going to continue to be a place that people are moving to, are moving not just their homes, but also moving their businesses to. We've seen a lot of new economic activity, people moving here to, you know, not just start large scale businesses or bring big scale businesses here, but just launch a small entrepreneurial startup. That's something that we want to encourage here. So what's really interesting that's going on in Montana is, you know, for a long time, our politics were kind of stuck in the 70s. And, you know, the 70s was the degrowth decade. That was when everybody thought that human progress and economic development was incompatible with the environment. And so a lot of our policies and politics in Montana for a long time, for the last 50 years, frankly, was focused on stopping development, stopping growth, preventing humans from kind of encroaching on environmental space. And what we're seeing now, particularly with all these regulatory successes, this red tape relief that we've seen the last 3 years, is there's a new way of looking at these issues that's emerging, and a new coalition that's being built around supply side reforms, reforms that make it easier for Montanans to create and innovate and build things again, so that we can address the big challenges that we have, whether it's building more homes, whether it's creating more energy, more abundant energy to power all the things that we need to power, whether it's enabling, you know, larger scale developments, or even projects that are good for the environment, like nuclear power plants and clean energy. These are all things that we're seeing a coalition of Montanans start to get behind that represents a new coalition, folks on the right and the left. So that makes me really optimistic about Montana's future, that we're embracing a future of innovation and abundance rather than scarcity and degrowth.
All right. I wanted to dig in a little bit on that, because you mentioned that a lot of those reforms that you've been passing were only available because you had a Republican trifecta, at least Republican legislature, Republican governor. They were interested in some solving some problems. You gave them a list of things to do. They followed through. Excuse me. They followed through on a lot of it. And I guess, and while you've just mentioned that we are trying to build a cross-ideological coalition to make sure that these things are robust, that they're going to continue, even if people vote for Democrats. So I guess my question is, how robust are these changes that you've made? Is this just going to dry up if voters' tastes change?
You know, that's a really good question. I think that that underscores why it's so important to build bipartisan consensus around these issues. You know, at the end of the day, with the political dynamics in Montana, you're right. All these changes, we didn't need Democrats to get on board with them in order for them to pass. But most of them, that especially the issues that we've worked on, have actually garnered pretty wide bipartisan support. And I think that that's really, really important, actually, not only in terms of thinking to the future and saying, well, hey, if things change and Democrats are in charge of the state, we want them to still be in favor of these policies, but also in terms of actually getting it done. I mean, whether you're Republican or Democrat, if you're a legislator and you're sitting in a committee and you have proposals coming before you, what you're thinking is trying to figure out where this proposal is coming from, and what lobbyist is pushing this idea, what interests are behind this. And when you see a proposal come forward, not just has groups on the right, also has groups on the left. You have a wide, diverse group of folks supporting it. As a legislator, you can say, you know what? I think that this idea is really well thought through. Somebody must have spent a lot of time working with other groups to refine this idea. And that gives them some peace of mind that they can say, I'm going to vote for this because it's probably a well thought through idea, not just some half-baked idea that's being pushed by a lobbyist or an interest group. So that's part of why our work at Frontier Institute, I view, is so important to the state. You know, we're not representing an industry interest or something like that. We're about the ideas, and we can help bring people together to advance those ideas, no matter their perspective.
Okay, so we didn't talk about this too much, but there were some tax cuts that were going on in Montana. Mm-hmm. And I think that tax cuts are something that a lot of people expect from Republicans. But loosening occupational licensing rules, putting limits on restrictive zonings, those are not so much Republican coded. There are expansive licensing regimes and zoning restrictions in red states too. So why do you think lawmakers in Montana targeted those issues?
Well, I think that it really was, as I mentioned earlier, I think it was the urgency of many of the issues that we're dealing with in Montana. You know, like I said, if you look at any of the big issues, it's a problem of supply. You know, we don't have enough healthcare, we don't have enough houses, and really, if you're a Republican legislator, one of the top solutions that should be at the top of your mind for addressing a supply side issue is getting the government out of the way and letting people build and create those things that we need. Because the market will respond if we let it. So I think that that's what is driving a lot of it. And, you know, it's not just localized to Montana either. I think that the United States in general is dealing with a lot of these issues. The housing crisis is felt in many states, not just Montana. And we're seeing a movement nationally to address these local regulations that are preventing people from building affordable types of homes. I think that we're seeing occupational licensure be loosened up broadly. In fact, that's something that we saw nationally during the pandemic, right? When we actually were faced with an emergency, we loosened regulations on telehealth, for instance. Mm-hmm. And that really helped increase access to healthcare when we needed it. States like Montana, that was one of the things that we did, is we actually locked in those regulatory reforms. We said, hey, if it worked during the pandemic, why don't we keep this going and make it easier for people to access telehealth permanently? So that was something that we focused on too. You know, on the Republican side of things, there's always been an interest in regulatory reform and red tape relief. In certain areas. So for instance, the right has for a long time embraced school choice and making it easier for education entrepreneurs to offer education options to parents and families and for families to choose those options. But there hasn't been a lot of focus on occupational licensing and housing, which, like you said, tended to be, you know, the bread butter issues of the left. And I think that what's happening is these problems are getting bad enough where Republican legislators are starting to say, well, hey, if you know more competition and more options and red tape relief works in these areas, it should work in all areas too. So let's try that first before we go in and spend more taxpayer money.
Yeah. Now, I do want to talk a little bit about opposition to these things. To these reforms. You said you've built up, tried to build up, at least on the occupational licensing and zoning issues, a good cross-ideological support for changes. But the reason why we have occupational licenses is that a lot of people who are engaged in the practice prefer there to be barriers of entry to enter the profession. It's a matter of protectionism for those occupations, and at least for the people who are engaged in them, they try and protect those protections, like a mother wolverine, I think is how I heard someone say it in the past. And the kind of the same thing with restrictive zoning rules. There are a lot of people who support, defend that. But what I think is interesting on this rate is that states are doing something about these issues. You can build up a cross-ideological coalition of people and make changes, at least on the state level. Now, Congress is weird, and I don't like it, but when you look at some of these issues, the same political dynamics are at play in Washington, D.C., but it seems that if it's not a matter of writing checks, Washington, D.C. can't do it. So why are these things more feasible in the states than they are in the federal government?
Well, I think that one reason good policy reform is more feasible in the states right now is, especially in a place like Montana, our lawmakers and policymakers are so accessible. We have a part-time legislature that meets 90 days every two years. And yes, the legislative session is fast and furious, but outside of legislative sessions, if you're just an average citizen and you have an idea or you have a concern, typically you can go find your representative's cell phone number on the legislative website and give them a text or a call and say, hey, let's go get a beer and let's talk about this. So, you know, that's a big opportunity for people to make change. That's one reason why I care so much about the work that we're doing in the states, because you know, a lot of people are frustrated with politics right now at the national level, and they feel like it's hopeless. But there's so much opportunity to do good work here at the local and state levels that's really where we ought to turn our attention. And one of the things that I've found is that, you know, these legislators, oftentimes, they're not professional politicians. They're farmers and ranchers and business owners. And honestly, they ran for office because they just want to do the right thing and they want to do something good for their community. And it's our jobs to provide them ideas and things that they can do that will actually make a difference that are consistent with their philosophy and their worldview that we should have a limited government and respect people's freedoms. One of the things that I've advocated for is that we need to think about things systematically. And when we're faced with a problem, oftentimes people just jump to the end and they say, oh, let's get the government involved and let's spend taxpayer money and let's get the government to solve this issue. We really should flip that around, and we should start first with saying, you know, what barriers are in the way at the state and local level are standing in the way of entrepreneurs in the marketplace somewhere solving this problem? Why don't we address those things first? And then once we have that house in order, then let's say, okay, what's going on at the federal level? Let's get those barriers out of the way. And once we've completed all of those steps, then maybe we can talk about what the government needs to do to help. But that should be the last question, not the first.
Kendall, good luck in your attempts to shift the Overton window.
Thank you.